This is an interview with Wes Roberts and Leslie Mitchell Clark, and it is the first edition of the LightworkHypnosis.com feature, Heart to Heart. Okay. Well, Mr. Roberts, thank you so much for stopping by the Lightwork Hypnosis headquarters. I'm very, very happy that you can be here to chat with me this afternoon about some of the aspects of my hypnotherapy practice. And as always, anything goes. Ask me anything you would like, and we'll get underway.
Thanks. Thanks a lot for having me here.
My pleasure.
I suppose one of the first questions that I get from people that don't know is the difference between experiencers and abductees.
I think that that's really an excellent question, for one thing. I think when we talk about abductees, we are really talking about a certain type of experience, if you will. And abductees would be people probably more like Betty and Barney Hill, you know, back from the 50s, people who have missing time, usually when they've been traveling from point A to point B, or during your sleep cycle. There's profound missing time. They have a physical experience with their corporeal body. It's a really physicalized ordeal, I would have to say, where they are literally abducted, taken by various means, either from their mode of transport or their homes, and generally speaking, brought on board a literal craft, something that is very physical to our dimension, and they have sometimes really odious and painful physical procedures performed, often involving implants, sometimes crude, sometimes not. Sometimes they involve the taking, the abducting, if you will, of reproductive materials. And these experiences are 9 times out of 10 buried in the unconscious mind, because the beings that took someone in an abductee experience use a type of hypnotherapy to suppress the memories. But we're much more, you know, we're much more clever than they think, because the memories will bubble out, and I'm here to help people do that. But when I hear the term abductee, I think of a traumatic experience. And in fact, people who have been multiple abductees with this kind of experience that I've just described invariably have some type of post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, they've been violated multiple times, often since the time they were very tiny children. Now, experiencers embraces a much larger, and I would have to say much more esoteric, range of experience. In the sense that it can involve experiences that take place with one's etheric body, if you will. The experiences and the encounters with the beings tend to be much more positive, philosophical, not physically invasive in the sense that we think of, you know, brutal testings. Experiencers can have something significant happen to them really at any time. They can be having a nap in the daytime, and their etheric body it's almost like an out-of-body experience. Their etheric body can travel into the dimension where the beings can then have their experience with the individual take place. So experiencers, it's a more esoteric, dare I say it, almost a more highly evolved, spiritually oriented experience.
I would tend to agree with that. Mm-hmm. I've had an interest in UFOs and the abduction experience all my life, mm-hmm. but I was uncomfortable with the word abductee.
Yes.
So I could never bring myself until very recently, to even consider myself to be in that category of person, thinking that I don't know if I've ever physically been taken. But emotionally, spiritually, psychically, the etheric body type, yes, for sure I have. And so it took me a long, long time and combating my own personal prejudice against the thought of abductee. I'm not one of those people.
Right.
I'm not from the back 40.
Right.
You know, I'm not one of those people that underwent the anal probe stuff.
Yes.
And are in some hills somewhere where nobody's going to believe me even if I do talk about it. So I began to consider myself an experiencer. I like the term, even if the world's not used to it yet. And I like your explanation of it.
Oh, thank you very much. I think what's probably important to keep in mind is that it's my belief and the belief of many both experiencers and abductees that we're dealing with visits from multiple extraterrestrial cultures, going back to really the dawn of human experience. In fact, it's further my belief that we were seeded and genetically manipulated in ancient prehistory by sophisticated beings. So we have multiple beings visiting us. And I think for me, at the very bottom of the ladder would be what people would commonly call the Greys or the Zeta Reticulites. And it's my belief that they have a kind of a dark agenda. And they basically are tagging us like cattle. And they are, they are the ones responsible, if we are to believe the recovered memories. The Zeta Reticulites are primarily responsible for the invasive, brutal, physical types of abductions that people experience. If you go online and Google the Disclosure Project, it's a very interesting piece of footage. It's about 10 years old, but it's a roundup of about 20 scientists, astronauts, FAA officials, and it was held at the press conference center at the White House. And all of these individuals, these highly decorated, highly credible individuals, got up and made statements essentially about what the government knows. And one of these individuals made a statement that the government, our own United States government, is aware of I believe the figure was 57 different ethnicities, if you will, or 57 different varieties or streams of extraterrestrial beings that visit us regularly. So this is a really complex matter. We have beings from the highest spiritual zones with the best possible intentions who are probably genetically related to us. We are them, they are us. And we have all the way down at the end of the spectrum the nasty little Zeta Reticulites with their, breeding program or whatever the heck they've got going on.
So this is where some people have stopped listening to the interview at this stage.
I imagine!
it's difficult for some people to wrap their head around the fact that there are alien life forms, let alone different species. Something I believe in as well, and I totally believe in the seated part.
Yeah.
I'm one of those people who have always thought there's something different about me that cannot be normally explained or in any other way explained.
Yeah.
Something really unique and different. But what would you say to the people out there that say alien life forms or abductees are a load of crap? Disbelieving types?
Well, I would have to say that if you can remain open-minded, if you can just remain open-minded, there is a lot of very perfunctory, journalistic, fact-based material out there that can open your mind, if you will. I would recommend particularly in investigating the material of Zechariah Sitchin, who just passed away, but he was a multiply degreed linguist who translated, one of the few people who could translate ancient Sumerian glyphs, if you will. And there's an awful lot of information through Zechariah Sitchin, who is a scientist, who can go ahead and enlighten you about how a prehistory that involves alien intervention is not really in conflict with any of the contemporary religious materials. I think that's the thing. I think if you're a an evangelical Christian or a very orthodox Muslim or any other religious sect, the material of Zachariah Sitchin does not interfere or in fact negate the material in the Old Testament, the basic creation in Genesis. It's simply a more enhanced way of looking at it. Now also, a very good place to go is, is it the UFO Project? There are all kinds of resources for fact-based research into the experiencer or alien abduction phenomena. All kinds of very dispassionate materials out there. The material of Frank Corso, Brigadier General Frank Corso, The Day After Roswell, completely fact-based material from a decorated military man. All you have to do is go over to HMV and look in the book section and keep your mind open.
So maybe this is the key thing, that there are facts surrounding this, not just myths. Some of the people that you've mentioned I'm familiar with, they're the John Macks of the world.
Mm-hmm.
These people employ protocol and process and procedure.
Yes.
In some cases, scientific measurements.
Yes.
NASA is the perfect example of an organization that's released footage from time to time, and from time to time it's leaked out.
Yeah.
Of UFOs that astronauts have encountered while on space missions.
Yes, yes. And not just astronauts, test pilots, regular pilots in the FAA, commercial pilots. I mean, the information that's been suppressed is absolutely mind-blowing. And it seems to me as if the incidences of visual contact, encounters of the first kind, visual contact, are accelerating at a phenomenal rate, particularly in Mexico, Russia. There was a thing that happened in our own country, in Canada. There have been phenomenal increases in UFO sightings, which you can look at that one in two ways. Either people are becoming more aware of the possibility of alien visitation, and that is opening their minds to the possibility of visual sightings, or the beings that are visiting us are preparing us and making it easier to see them, or more people are coming into the world, are being born into the world, that have capabilities of seeing further into the light spectrum.
The whole question of fact and real, some people think that the only thing that is real is something that is manifest,
mm-hmm.
that has physical form.
Yeah.
And so I think we're both talking about the same thing right now, that not all aliens are physical.
Exactly.
Are manifest in this world, or manifest in a way that our physics or science would understand.
Exactly. Exactly. We are living in a level of dense physical reality, dense matter. But even so, we are multidimensional beings. We're sort of stuck here in school, I think, plodding about in this mm-hmm. dense physical matter. And I really think that, internal experiences of the soul and of the mind are every bit as real, whether or not they're manifested in physical matter. And I truly believe that some of the extraterrestrial cultures that we are engaged with are interdimensional beings and may or may not have physical form that we can see. See, everything is vibration. Everything mm-hmm. is vibration. And it's my belief that if we had the ability to perceive more quickly moving photons or electrons, we would be able to perceive more visual manifestations. In other words, it's also my belief that, although we're not talking about this specifically, but in the spirit realm, when we pass out of our bodies and we're living in our etheric body and we move to the spirit realm, that that's not in some far distant place, but is sort of superimposed. And some people simply have the ability to perceive really quickly moving photonic elements and can see spirit manifestation.
And that's a perfect segue to real. I know a lot of people who, hands down, no questions asked, believe in the spirit, or believe that deceased people walk the earth, or believe in God, or believe in Satan, or believe in anything else, even believing in the subconscious. None of these things are tangible.
None.
And so why should an alien life form be any less tangible than a figure from the afterlife?
I think it's just fear-based. I think the idea that we don't have complete control of our reality, if you will, or our environment, is terrifying. It's the same kind of, you know, ridiculous fear that the caveman must have felt as he poked his head out of his cave and made a mad dash, you know, over to, you know, grab some berries or whatever. It's fear based. We're afraid of what we don't know, of what we can't understand. And fears and ignorance, of course, are the same thing. And the more I have found terrific openness just accelerating in the past several years at a phenomenal rate. Before, when I could only discuss these matters with either clients or a limited amount of friends, I'm basically seeing openness to this really everywhere, and also in young people. Young people who are teens, I suppose, like my own sons, they seem to have been born with an innate acceptance and sort of consider themselves sort of citizens of the universe rather than citizens of the world. They're concerned, you know, like my kids and their friends, they're concerned not only with the ecosystems of the world, but with the universal environment. It's just a new kind of person is coming in.
So those of us in our 30s, 40s, or 50s, not so much have to learn things as unlearn them.
Yes. Yeah.
We have to learn to trust our instinct. If I can believe that my dead mother can visit me, which I do,
yes,
it's not too much of a stretch to think that an alien can visit me.
Well, for me, not at all. For me, not at all. And because I really do believe that there are some really benevolent, helpful extraterrestrial beings who do visit us in the etheric sense regularly. I mean, I've seen it happen right in this office. I've felt it myself. I've had visual experiences myself. So to me, there just simply is no question. And you know, why, as you say, it was an interesting point you had earlier, why we should consider that less real. You know, the way the human body works, our nervous systems do not know the difference between dream states and so-called states of reality. Now, if we're constructed that way, if we're set up that way, doesn't it follow to say that what is real and what is not real must, in a sense, be something above and apart from our physical selves?
Absolutely. And, excuse me, extending that a bit, our memories are real. And so whether our memories come from a dream or from an abduction or from an experience with someone in the afterlife, our memories are real. We seem to believe in our memories, but you can't put your finger on them.
No.
You know, they're not located in any particular spot.
No. In fact, some of the current scientific thinking is that, you know, our consciousness, in a sense, does live outside of our physical being. In some kind of subatomic way, all the information, everything that we are, is vibrating and living, you know, in a submolecular kind of sense, outside of the body. So that makes perfect sense to me.
I have a friend that calls it non-local.
Non-local, yeah. Exactly.
Consciousness is non-local.
It's completely non-local, and you know, it's many people, you know, average folk on the street have had at least one incidence where maybe there was a mother-child thing where they knew something was wrong, with their child or that some circumstance had become stressful or upsetting, and it doesn't matter what the physical difference is. They could be one block down at the preschool, or they could be across the world in China. There really is no distance. These are illusions. This is illusory stuff. The Seth material is something very good to read for anyone who has wants to explore further, perhaps the nature of reality. I would say run right out and get the Seth material. And that will have, and now everything in the Seth material, which came out in the 50s and 60s, has now been corroborated by our current information from the scientific point of view.
So we've been stuck in our whole lives a learning system that's caused us to feel that emphasis is on the finite.
Yes. Yeah.
And so anything beyond the finite, which we think to be our physical science, or matter, or material, or something mm-hmm. that our five or six senses can anticipate or experience, that is all.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've spent my whole life trying to think I need to forget some of the stuff
yes.
I was taught.
Yeah.
In order to accept this. The reason I came to you, not changing subjects, but digging back deeper into my own history, was mm-hmm. that about 23 years ago, I had my first recalled experience that I did not know what it was. I did not call it an abduction. Mm-hmm. I did not call it an alien experience. Mm-hmm. It was an experience where time was altered, where I appeared to be taken somewhere to a staging area, mm-hmm. or I appeared to be shown some things, and then just as quickly ushered back. Mm-hmm. And I was ushered back to this state of being when I started to want to stay there and experience it some more. So 23 years ago, fast forward to about 3 years ago, when I thought, I got to get some answers here. Mm-hmm. I have to get some answers. I didn't know what that was. I'd written it off as a dream or some odd experience, but it just doesn't fit dream or some odd experience. 3 years ago, I began looking for somebody to help me. About 6 or 9 months ago, I found you and brought this to you, and I recall in our very first session when I came out of it, I said, is all this stuff real? Mm-hmm. And so that sort of brings me to a question I have in my own mind, and maybe we can both explore a little mm-hmm. bit. How do we know it's an abduction or an alien experience versus anything else?
Very, very interesting. Well, one thing I would say about the process of hypnosis, it's extremely truth-based. When you're talking to someone's subconscious mind, all the filters are gone. And I can simply say, in the case of yourself, I was able to get you fairly into quite a deep trance. This type of work, as far as exploring any kind of memory repression, whether it's an experiencer or an abduction sequence or something traumatic from your childhood, it requires quite a deep trance. So I spent a lot of time getting you where you needed to be, where you could observe everything. Now, emotions, human emotions in hypnosis are not manufactured. People don't lie and they don't make constructs and they don't when they're in trance. And as a professional, it's my training and my experience tells me how to recognize exactly where someone is. We have depth testing and we have other things that we do. So when someone is in deep trance, and say they're recalling an experience of perhaps experience or abduction, and emotions start coming out of fear and or puzzlement or disorientation. These are things that are not constructed in the subconscious mind. They simply are not. When we get to that level, we're really dealing with what you as an entity believe to be true and have, and that's why hypnosis is used even by the police. They put witnesses under to see if further facts can be garnered, or it's used all the time to get past that ego level where we construct lies and defenses.
You mentioned the word trauma, and I'm thinking about this. Before I came to see you, I would have considered myself to be fearless.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not afraid of death. I'm not afraid of anything I know of.
Yeah.
Yet, by the time I came to making my appointment with you, I experienced something akin to a panic attack.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is not like me.
Yeah.
This is just not my model.
Yeah.
And I remember the process you took me through and going down fairly deep.
Mm-hmm.
And experiencing emotions and then the after effects of the trauma. And I thought, this stuff is so fantastic that I've got to be making it up.
In my opinion, absolutely not. That would run counter to how the scientific process of hypnosis works and what your brain is doing. In my opinion, everything that you recounted was completely legitimate. And of course, when we got into working with you, I mean, we went back quite far.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the first several sessions, we dealt with a lot of experiences that happened when you were very little. And I think some of that fear and trepidation was really more attached to those childhood experiences that you didn't understand and that you felt powerless around. And they were unpredictable. And you didn't know when they were going to happen. You just couldn't understand them. And I think a lot of that fear was very tied up with those memories that you had protected and hid pretty well from yourself.
So there were events, things, experiences that happened in my life that I had no other explanation for.
Yeah.
Not dreams. Not necessarily spiritual experiences, not necessarily typical altered states, no altered states brought on by drugs or anything like that,
right.
But things that happen, in some cases, quite against my will.
Yes, yes, I think that's absolutely true. And when we say against your will, I think it was against part of your will. I think loss of control with you is a huge thing. And I think it was the potential loss of control that was so disturbing to you. However, I think when we got deeper into the sessions, I think it was only part of you that felt the loss of control. That you were and are a real participant in something that's extremely important. Extremely important. You're sort of chosen, in a sense, to, as some people are, to help lead us into the next Earth phase, which is going to be quite different from what we have lived in the ego and greed-based world that you and I grew up in.
I know that you know I agree with you on this, and we've talked about this many times privately, and it's always been a question for me of, what's this message that I'm harboring?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what's the message? What's the hidden message that I'm harboring? What are these things I've been going through?
Yeah.
Why do I feel different than everyone else? What's my place in all this?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you talk about not totally against my will,
mm-hmm.
I'd have to agree with that in that there must be some form of consent.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there's consent with physical abductees that mm-hmm. undergo medical experiments.
Certainly not, yes.
Because I don't believe there is, and
no.
Who would?
Yeah, and who would? Yeah.
But in something like this, there must be some overriding or underlying consent that we had come to with an alien species, one or more of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they and we are acting on that consent, even if the consent is not in my conscious mind.
Yes, yeah.
So maybe this is going to help our listeners decide something about an earlier question we talked about is, what's an abduction? How do you know it was an alien experience?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Boy, these are very ephemeral issues, but I agree with you wholeheartedly that there is an agreement, and particularly with the encounters that you have had, we're dealing with really a benevolent culture of beings that you are very closely tied with for various reasons, possibly through various lifetimes. I believe through various lifetimes. And I don't think you're alone or isolated in any kind of way. It's my belief that there are many, many, many thousands, maybe even millions of people like yourself who are here on this earth plane now to teach and guide as we move into a new way of thinking about everything. we're going to reach a point where we're no longer alone. Can you imagine what that will do when we realize that we are not alone, that we're not out here on this rock, this speck of dust, meaninglessly slogging about for material gain? It will change everything. Because I think as a people, as a planetary people, we long to go back to the stars. We have a longing in us to return to where we came from. And because it is my belief that you know, Homo sapiens, the beings that we are today, are not the result of random natural selection, but you know, whatever indigenous part of us that there was melded with DNA from, in my belief system, the people from Nibiru who began the Sumerian culture. There's a huge part of us, a part of everyone, that longs to go home. And we have that longing at the core of our being. It's part of the feelings that we have of loneliness and separateness. Separateness is an illusion. It's an illusion, and it's the kind of illusion that's been perpetuated by the institutions of man on Earth, the Catholic Church, and I'm a former Catholic, so I mean, this kind of narrow viewpoint of reality has imprisoned us. We've imprisoned ourselves.
It's funny you would talk about looking towards the stars, because this very thought occurred to me on the way down here today. Why do people face the night sky for their answers?
Yeah.
Is it some stupid myth to do with astronomy, or because we've explored everything else? And it's not.
No.
We don't look at a patch of Earth or in a planet. We look to the stars, and I think we're looking to where we are from.
Yep. I absolutely believe that. We have a pull. We have an emotional, spiritual pull that is really profound and really strong in some people, but the pull is in every single human being on this planet. We are all them, they are us. And even, you know, there are now even physiological things that are now associated with people who are carrying a lot of extraterrestrial DNA. One of those things is negative Rh, negative rhesus factors in your blood. These are people who are carrying a lot of, you know, a lot of DNA from our forebears. And some of the other things just simply involve neuroskeletal structure, height. You know, the indigenous part of us is not very big. You know, people who are tall and have slender, tall structure are manifesting most closely, I think, our progenitors.
So you can't see me out there, folks, but this would be me.
That would be you.
This would be me.
And my mother, too, although she's a complete dolt and barbarian. There's nothing but you know, that type of what we would think of as a Scandinavian, mm-hmm. maybe more of a Scandinavian build. These are, according to a lot of information, this is what our progenitors look like. I reject this idea of the reptilian Anunnaki myself. I know you'll see if you go online, you start Googling Anunnaki, Nibiru, you will see some information come up with people who really are deluded into thinking that they were reptilian beings. I think there's a big confusion with space helmets, to tell you the truth. And in the material of Alexander Sitchin, they refer to their like space gear as, what do they call it? They call them the eagle helmets or something like that. So I think indeed some of this comes from a big misunderstanding. But I don't believe in that reptilian thing. I don't believe that the reptilians have invaded our government. I think we've done enough of a bad job with our government completely on our own. I don't think we need any reptilians in there.
Our personification of angels and demons.
Yeah.
Comes to mind because of our inability to interpret what it was we were experiencing.
Yes.
But now we can.
Yeah.
So, and this also ties into the whole height thing, because you and I have explored someone who's closely connected with me.
Mm-hmm.
I call her my twin.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen her a couple of times, and she would be, in our measurement, 7 or 8 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
and straight up and down.
Yeah.
No figure to speak of or anything.
No. In fact, the idea of femininity, which I also perceive strongly, too, she's definitely a feminine being, but not necessarily with the manifestations that we think of here in, as far as sex and gender. This part is a little bit unclear. Well, more than a little bit, this part is kind of unclear to me. But definitely the soul identity, or the identity of this being that you share genetic material with, is definitely female. I feel.
I think, I strongly feel she is, and I think we have to be discerning types, mm-hmm. and skeptical types.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I leave something like this for 23 years? If I weren't skeptical, you know?
You are skeptical, and I think you did everything that your conscious mind could do to suppress and organize this information into some way that you could understand it. And there was certainly a lot of suppressed information there when you were first coming to see me, because as you mentioned earlier in our interview here, your first experience that you had any kind of conscious memory of was at 23. However, when we started exploring this further, you've had experiences. The earliest one, you were about 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You're almost pre-verbal. And I tend to think, and I don't know whether you feel this or not, but I think the childhood experiences were probably much more physical. In other words, I would tend to believe that they were, that your physical body was transported, the whole package. It was only later, after you got to a certain point of understanding, that the etheric body experiences began happening. This is what I tend to feel from looking over the tapes and the information, that your childhood experiences were very physical, that you were physically moved from one place to another, put on sets that would be familiar, interacted with other child beings, some human beings, some people turned off and turned on. Well, actually, that's another thing we should probably talk about, is how in the realm of your experience, some of the things that happened to you after the age of 20, in fact, there was someone else, you know, a wife or partner with you, who was turned off.
Yeah, this whole concept of switching people off is how I refer to it.
Yeah.
I was living with my partner, and we went to sleep one night, and during the night, this is my first experience, I woke up at around 5 a.m., and time was warped for me for a few seconds and everything else, and I went out and wrote down my experience. My partner, I'll just call her Elle, had known that something was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it at that point. Fast forward, to use that term, to about 18 years after that, and she revealed to me in email that wasn't the first experience, that she recalled hearing everything.
Oh, yeah.
In that first experience and a second one. In the second one, she heard me talking with these beings in another room, and I still don't know all of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And she was unable to move.
Yeah.
She was unable to move or speak, but she was able to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's my opinion that she is one of many people that are routinely switched off.
Yeah.
So they can't interfere, and the aliens have no interest in them anyway.
Yeah, for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know well, but I absolutely concur. And you can, who's the marvelous guy who does so much research into alien abduction and also experience. This idea of someone being switched off is extremely common.
That would be Bud Hopkins?
Bud Hopkins,
yes.
Is who I'm speaking of. This idea of being switched off is something that you find commonly, regularly. It seems that they have interest in specific people, and they, as you say, as you just said so succinctly, they don't want any interference and what they're doing with the people who matter. So they simply switch off. And the fact that your partner was able to hear things in an audio sense is a little bit unusual. Generally speaking, the experiencer looks over and they see their partner, who is who appears to be in a coma,
right,
and immobilized,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that you're the partner at that time, that might indicate some sensitivity on her part. I'm not sure.
Well, she claims to have had a physical abduction years later,
oh.
which she's never explored, fearful to the nth degree.
Wow.
I cannot tell you how afraid she is to
That's
go there.
Too bad. I'd love to get her in the chair and see what we could find out. But so anyway, that's a very common thing for mm-hmm. somebody to be actually shut off. It happened to me many, many years ago. I was probably about 18. I was away at a summer theater with a boyfriend, and I recall hearing an incredible, well, I guess you'd call it a whirring, not a motor sound, almost like a bunch of wings, kind of a whirring, hovering above the cabin where we were, and all of the outside lights were all of the outside windows were illuminated with incredible light. So I was able to perceive that for a moment, and then I was out. I remember that much of it. I remember not being able to move my arms and legs or speak. And I feel very strongly that it was my partner at the time that they were interested in. He was a very special person. He is now, he passed away not too long ago from a rare brain tumor, which we have found some evidence of that in people that have been really abducted and had implants. And I mean, certain kinds of cancers are not uncommon with people who have been physically abducted by the reticulites, whether that's related or not. But I understand what it is to be flipped off, to be flipped off too, but to be switched off. It's very disconcerting.
Well, the flipping off and switching off actually takes place in two forms, as I think we've explored. Mm-hmm. One is in the physical.
Yeah.
So L, in my case, was physically switched off in this state, in a
yeah.
physical manifest state. Another of my experiences that we explored one day while I was under, I had entered it through what I thought was a dream, so this is more etheric abduction
mm-hmm.
Scenario, and I was fighting being switched off.
Yeah.
There are people sitting on the couch with me who just had their head over like they were asleep, but I wasn't one of them.
Yeah.
And one being who entered the room was apparently having an argument with me about my not being switched off.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this. So that switched off part was done in a very etheric, dreamlike, altered state of consciousness.
Yeah.
Psychically, spiritually.
Exactly.
Some of those beings were there. Their human bodies were asleep, but they were present psychically. And some of them were psychically shut off.
Yes. Fascinating.
Yeah.
But absolutely true. There are those two different aspects of being shut off. And you know, in in our sessions where we've explored your significant experiences, you did give them the beings a lot of trouble in various circumstances, especially when you were a teenager. There was one particular session where you recounted again, and this I think was, as you were a teenager, this was more of an etheric experience. This wasn't necessarily physical, but they had set up some type of a construct where they wanted apparently to study your reactions or your emotions, and it was supposed to be some kind of teen party, and you just were not having it to the point where they had to deposit you right back home without even going through what they had planned.
Yeah, it ended quickly.
It ended quickly for them. Yeah. And so they got their first, well, not their first, but they got a big dose of adolescent rebellion.
I wish I still had it. Your experience where you were switched off, how much time went by? Was that a case of missing time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely missing time. Because I was conscious when the big illumination happened, and I could hear the big whirring of some type of power source or engine, and then the next thing I remembered, it was 5 a.m, and I just remember I had to like urinate really badly, and I was so freaked out, I didn't want to leave the cabin, but I hiked up to the bathhouse. These were primitive accommodations. I hiked up to the bathhouse, and actually, now I remember that the urination was incredibly painful. It's a funny thing. I hadn't thought about this for many, many years, but that was part of the experience. So I would say, I would say there were at least 5 or 6 hours of missing time.
How can we coach people to seek out a venue in which to talk about their experience? Because it took me, a person who I consider to be fearless myself, mm-hmm. ages to get to the point
yeah.
where I would admit that this is probably what has happened to me
yeah.
and admit that I need to find out more about it. And my motivation is pretty pure motivation. I want to be a conscious participant.
Yes.
So for listeners out there, how can we coach people to come in and see you, or to make a decision about who they want to see, but to see someone?
I think that, I think that the media is doing part of that already, as you and I have discussed. Now on mainstream media is simply loaded with programs based on ancient aliens, UFO experiences, paranormal activity of all sorts. So I think that the gestalt, the group consciousness of our world is being prepared. However, I would have to say that people need to be fearless. They need to dispel fear. And fear is what keeps the memories locked down. The locking down of the memories causes disturbing feelings. It can lead to depression, anxiety. It's essential to be fearless and to open your mind to the possibility that you yourself might be a special person. You might have a role to play in the future and how the future manifests itself on our planet. And be fearless. And you don't have to come see me, but we can certainly act as a resource center. No matter where you're living, in what country, I have a wide network of hypnotherapists who are dealing with this issue. We can find someone for you who will work with you and get rid of... Because if you're a person, if you're an experiencer or an abductee, I would guarantee that the suppression of these memories is interfering with other aspects of your life. I would guarantee it, that you are going through, that it's affecting you in your relationships, perhaps your inability to be trusting and close to other people. Perhaps you have sleep disorders. It could manifest itself in any kind of way. And only you yourself, you can put yourself in a meditative state, just a relaxed state, and ask yourself the question, is it possible? Or allow me to examine my own experiences. Just open draw the veil aside. And, I would urge anyone who feels that they've had experiences to contact us through lightworkhypnosis.com, and we can refer you to see someone. And it's also my hope that that Wes and myself can put together a sort of a think tank, if you will, a group of people who are experiencers and who want to pool our resources, as it were, to examine this question and help others and move forward in a partnership with our extraterrestrial friends, with the extraterrestrial beings that were here. I want to move together in partnership. And I feel strongly that that's what they want too.
I think they do. And so I'm going to throw in my availability as well, mm-hmm. and say that if people need to get a hold of me, they can do so. But we just tread into some uncertain and difficult territory for some. So it may be time to do a reality check. Mm-hmm. It's like, we're not saying if you feel special, like you're a delinquent.
Oh, right.
If you feel special, like you're disjointed or you're dysfunctional,
mm-hmm.
Or if you feel special because you're a goth or something. It's not that kind of special.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a kind of special that most people do not want.
Right.
You know, and that was me. It's like, I don't, at least consciously, don't remember agreeing to this.
Yeah.
Although evidently I did.
Yeah.
But the whole special part is not just because, gee, I don't fit in because I'm a nerd.
Yeah.
It's not that kind of special at all.
No, it's not. I was perhaps a poor choice of words.
No, not a bit.
Yeah, but I'm glad. Thank you for clarifying that. That's we're really anxious to hear from you, whether even with your questions.
Yes.
Especially with your questions. If you want to contact us and say, well, A, B, and C have happened, do you think that this could be an abduction experience or something else?
And I wholeheartedly agree with that. Mine was not a criticism. It's like, instead it was like a personal vendetta for people that think, you know, I'm going to build up to be something, or because I'm nothing in my own opinion, I have low self-worth or whatever.
Right.
I'll pick this.
Yeah.
This will be the thing that I'm special for.
Yeah.
And it's like, for me, it's become evident over decades that I am this thing.
Yeah.
So it wasn't something that came up right away because I didn't fit in the bowling league.
Right.
You know, sort of deal.
Right.
And so mine is not a criticism of you at all. It's mainly that if you've been listening to the interview, you've heard several things that would tell you what might constitute an alien experience.
Yes, yes, yes.
Several signs.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the ones you mentioned, Leslie, that is just banging me in the head right now to talk about it, it's light. It's the light.
Yeah.
Because more than one of my experiences have involved intense, unbelievably intense white light.
Yes, yes.
And yours did,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yes, yes.
So what is it with the light? Well, I think that's a sign that something's going on in terms of alien interference.
Yeah.
But there's something about the light that transmits.
Yeah.
It carries information with it. It's capable of putting us under or making us more lively or enlightened. There's something about the light that struck me. So if you've been listening to this, you know, the full time that we've been discussing this so far, there are several things that you might look at. Leslie's saying, look at your life. You might look at and say, you know what? This could be an alien experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it is, and if, say, your wife or your kids or your husband or boyfriend or girlfriend is making you out to be dysfunctional, then that takes us back to the question of how do you approach someone like Leslie?
Mm.
If even at home, you're being told that you're quote-unquote mental, where do you go from there? How do you reach out? How do you have the nerve to reach out past that?
Yeah. Well, you know, Einstein would have been told he was autistic, you know, if in today's time. You know, he was simply thinking deep thoughts. So I think if you're being, I hate to think about anybody being, because my own husband is so open-minded, I hate to think about anybody being put down by their partner or by not being believed or being afraid to verbalize things. So as I said, get rid of the fear. There are millions of people, millions of doctors, lawyers, professional people, teachers, who have experienced things which are definitely outside of the realm of what we accept as physical reality. So there are millions upon millions of people who are simply perceiving more. And if you feel that you are a person, if you just have a question, I would be thrilled to hear it and to discuss it further, as would Wes.
And I have to say that there's the sound of the familiar when people start telling you things,
mm-hmm.
and you cock your eyebrow up and think, you know, that sounds really suspicious.
Yes, doesn't it, though? In fact, at this point, I might bring up something we haven't talked about yet, is how these experiences can run in families. And I think, again, this probably has to do with a genetic component in your individual family line. But I know that you had mentioned a young relative of yours recounted a story which was strongly suspicious of some type of experience or abduction. And oft times when little children are having these experiences, the beings tend to use imagery that they think the children will be comforted by. It can be, you know, often animals that almost look animated are used in the sense of yourself. There was a lot of that. Things that seemed to be cartoons but weren't. So they were, so the beings are trying very hard to create a comfortable experience for the people that they are interfacing with. They don't always get it right. They're imperfect like us. They're not gods. They're trying, but they're imperfect. And they try to use constructs, particularly with the young people that they are interfacing with, that they think are going to comfort them. It doesn't always work that way, because that's a very complex thing. And they seem to have, you know, big from your experiences, the beings seem to have big holes in their complete understanding of how we work and what we're about. They are amused by certain things that they don't quite get, and they take stuff out of our minds to try and comfort us. It doesn't always work, because they don't fully get it. I'm not sure if they understand our media. I'm not sure if they really understand the crudeness of broadcasting. I you know, there are things that they just don't seem to really fully get. They're trying to. And so would you say that in some of your, in probably the majority of the experiences that you had as a person, say, previous to 20, that it seemed almost like social research?
It did seem like some of the experiences were like experiments. Mm-hmm. It seems like they were staged.
Yes.
I've often thought of my experiences as being staged. It's like, this room is perfect.
Yeah.
These people have no expression, you know? This music is too cliche. All these sort of things enter your mind. It's not reality in all its imperfections. It's their version of it.
Yeah.
And speaking to that, we've just come to the point where we've thought, they don't understand that I need to sleep.
Oh, yeah.
So they don't get it.
No. That was something that we've dealt with fairly recently. And you yourself, as an individual, have had sleep issues all of your life. But part of it may be your own physiological makeup, but a significant part is that you apparently become vulnerable or open to the etheric experience at certain places in your sleep cycle. And so the beings are, you know, relentless with you. They don't understand that you have to pass through alpha and beta and delta, and that you need that kind of deep relaxation to continue on in your life. And we finally reached a point a couple of weeks ago where I think finally, maybe, that has been driven home. That's one area in which we differ from them. They may have rest periods, but we actually have to deeply conk out. We have to go to those deep levels of sleep in order to function in our physical world.
Well, you're very right about the vulnerability part, because I've had my little panic issues around that, thinking I can't go to sleep.
Yeah.
Because that's when I'm most vulnerable.
Yeah, understandably so, by the way.
But the interesting and logical thing about that, if we want to bring logic into the conversation, I think it's been in the conversation all the way through, is that because of what alien beings are capable of, you being asleep or awake makes no damn difference.
Right.
Conscious or unconscious, it makes no difference to them.
Right.
They're quite capable.
Yeah. They don't understand it fully.
Yeah.
I don't think.
And they can mess with us, so to speak, or interact with us if we want to be more optimistic, whether we're asleep or awake.
Yeah.
And probably always are. And you also talked about this running through families.
Yeah.
And so it would seem it does run through mine. Mm-hmm. I would have had no conception at all this occurred in my childhood. None. Zero. I thought it started in my 20s or 30s. That was it.
Yeah.
So to have experiences that take me back to being 3 or 4 years old was astounding to me. And probably, you're right, it was part of the disturbing aspect of it to me.
Yeah. Of course.
And then you think about this whole family issue, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about this. My partner claims to understand this to a certain degree intellectually, wonders why they're interfering with me. It's the why me thing. Mm-hmm. Which I ask myself all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure quite gets it, or, you know, I'm not sure to what extent she gets it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I accept her understanding of it, and I'm open to discussion. But I might be the lucky guy, because some people might not have families to do this for them.
I think you are the lucky guy. I think you are very fortunate to have a partner who, it's not necessary for her to experience the same things you do, but the fact that she's open and understanding and supportive is really marvelous. And of course, you know, we tend to draw the right people to us, I think, after a certain level of maturity. You know, I know I had a lot of, you know, but shall we say, questionable relationships before finally drawing, you know, the right people to me. And I think as something that I just feel, I think that for your work in your life, however that manifests itself, you need a partner like that. That's essential. Or you can't have a partner. You know, someone who was a scoffer and a skeptic and not understanding and couldn't see beyond the physical reality would not be a helpful person to you. They would be a detractor. You know, and that's not what you want. So I think you are the fortunate guy. I think there are a lot of people experiencing things who are just totally afraid to talk about them for fear of scoffing and retribution from either their partner or their family. I think that's true.
Well, you know, it's interesting because she's had to endure some pretty weird stuff.
Yeah.
Through me.
Yeah.
Some quite obvious tantrums.
Yeah.
You know, 2 or 3 years ago when I was struggling with this more than I am now, mm-hmm. Thinking, what the hell do you guys want?
Yeah.
What do you want from me? And you need to let me interact with you consciously. It's not mm-hmm. working
yeah.
this way. It's not a one-way street. And answer me and stuff like that. So I was going through this the past couple of years, particularly about 2 years ago, and it was affecting my everyday life.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure it was. And further to that, do you think that since we explored a lot of your childhood experiences and explored them and demystified them and took the fear factor away, do you think that that has had a positive influence on your psychological well-being? Do you think the repression of those memories was leading to certain negative behaviors or patterns?
I do. I think I'm a really stable person,
mm-hmm.
but I think at times it acted to destabilize me.
Yeah.
I can recall periods where I was feeling some mild depression, or feeling anger and not in touch with the anger, or feeling emotions that weren't mine.
Right.
And it's like, where the hell is all this stuff coming from?
Yeah.
You know, I really didn't know. And I think I'd said to you at one point, my work depends on contracts, and
mm-hmm.
I'd actually completely missed showing up to certain contracts.
Yes.
Completely missed them.
Yeah.
It's like my just basic organization 101 flew out the window. So for those of you who are listening to this and thinking, how can it impact your everyday life? In various ways,
mm-hmm.
It can impact your kids, it can impact your spouse,
mm-hmm.
your partner, your family, your friends. It can tend to destabilize you. And I think that brings me to, you know, a thought of what value is hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made a huge difference in my life in a short time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also allowed me, and this might just be a me thing, to be a more conscious participant.
Yes.
Which was my goal.
Yes.
So, but you can speak more, I think, Leslie, to what hypnosis can do to help a person.
Well, as you say, it is an extremely fast way to instigate change. You know, the way that most of us walk around in a light state of hypnosis, anyway, there's only a tiny little part of us that's what you would call fully conscious. We are in a light state of hypnosis. That's why we get, you know, hit with advertising on television. Once our beta waves get going, we're completely vulnerable to hypnotic suggestion. That being said, all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. So it's a partnership between the hypnotherapist and the client. You're the one who puts yourself in the deep state of relaxation that we know as hypnosis. And I think that the way the process works is say you've had a traumatic experience when you're a tiny little kid, you know, a near drowning experience. You were saved, you were okay, but the fear was there. So what would generally happen is you may not be able to remember that experience, but the unconscious mind creates a defense mechanism so that that will never happen to you again. And that defense mechanism is probably a phobia of water or swimming. So once the traumatic experience is uncovered, is looked at, then that elaborate defense mechanism preventing you from living a full life that has been created by your subconscious mind, once that is removed, the fear is removed. There is no more fear. The fear is like a defense mechanism that our psyche creates so that you never have that drowning experience again. And when, if we can get to that it factor, if we can get to that event, then we can take away that construct and we can take away the fear. Because in the light of day, it's a childhood fear. It's a childhood fear that has no bearing on the adult person. So with that kind of philosophy going and that kind of process, whether we're dealing with repressed memories of abductions or experiences, or whether we're dealing with, you know, abuse or a physical trauma, childhood physical trauma, adolescent physical trauma, the phobias and the fears can be taken away seemingly instantly once we get in there.
You know, this brings to mind a thought, and it's a non-expert's criticism. Everybody's a couch expert out there, right? Everybody has an opinion.
Yeah.
So some opinions of hypnosis run counter to what you're saying, you know, and I'm only bringing this up because I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But some opinions of hypnosis are that the hypnotist steers you in certain directions. Now, I don't know how much you'll be able to speak about this professionally, but I'm interested in our listeners hearing my opinion of it, and then perhaps yours. You know, my opinion is that when I'm hypnotized, basically I'm taken to a place where there's a blank slate.
Yes.
Is how I would describe it. But there's no suggestion that I'm on an alien craft. There's no suggestion that I'm having a medical experiment done on me.
Mm-hmm.
There's no suggestion that I will see a 7-foot tall being. There's none of this bullshit involved. So I know some people listening to this interview might think, well, this is what hypnosis does. You know, they take you to places where you don't want to go and they extract memories that aren't there and stuff like this, which I totally do not believe in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, number one, guys, if you're listening to this, I am always conscious.
Yes. Yes. People have a very Hollywood idea of what hypnosis is. Although you are really in a deeply relaxed state where you take away all the blockades that suppress memory and all these little things, they have no power once you get to the unconscious level, to the subconscious level. And as you say, Rob, in training as a hypnotherapist and consulting hypnotist, like, rule number one is you do not lead the client or the subject. You do not lead them. All of your inductions and your inductions have to be as neutral as possible when you are dealing with memory recovery. Now, obviously, if someone comes in for a specific type of treatment, say, they want to quit smoking, or they want to lose weight, things like that, we have specific suggestions that we give to people while they are in a state of hypnosis. And so we can talk directly to the unconscious. And that is the therapeutic, that is where the therapeutic aspect of hypnosis comes in, where you really try to affect positive change So that's when we use specific suggestions. But in the situation of memory recovery or any kind of exploratory situation, whether it's past life regression or anything like that, neutrality, complete neutrality is essential. Essential. Because people are vulnerable to suggestion when they're in hypnotic, when they're under hypnosis. They are vulnerable to suggestion completely. That's where you have like stage hypnotists.
Right.
You know, people who line everybody up on stage and make them act like chickens and things like that. People, we have a, as hypnotherapists and consulting hypnotists, we have a incredible ethical prime directive of neutrality. And not leading the subject into any direction other than where they want to go. And that's what a lot of our training is involved in, the process of inducing a state of hypnosis.
And I think that's critical that listeners understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a shelf full of books on this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and I'm sure, in fact, I know Leslie's well-read as well. You could pull out any experience from anyone else, and there's been tens of thousands documented at this point, and say, oh yeah, I have a scoop of skin missing from my forearm, mm-hmm. or they took semen on this particular journey, or they rearranged my guts or something like this.
Yeah.
All this stuff. And of course, none of that ever happened. It's more like, let's go to a place where you can remember.
Yeah.
Where you can recall actual events. You'll tell me, the hypnotist, I can't tell you because I don't know what they are, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I've always felt, and we've gone through a dozen sessions
mm-hmm.
and a dozen different scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, all the stuff is from me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Although sometimes we do agree before the session on kind of where you want to go.
Yes.
I can put you where you want to go. After that, you are in complete control.
And that's another thing, if you have not undergone hypnosis, you do not lose control.
No.
You're in control. I've never lost consciousness.
No.
In one of these sessions.
Right.
Due to some strange things that have happened to me in real time,
mm-hmm.
which is something Leslie and I have been experimenting with,
mm-hmm.
communicating with these beings in real time,
mm-hmm.
I felt dizzy, nauseous, I felt sick, I felt extreme heat,
mm-hmm.
I felt like I might pass out. This is nothing that's going on in terms of hypnosis.
Right.
This is something from them, and
yeah.
this is a physiological change I'm
yes.
undergoing.
Yes.
So hypnosis doesn't and shouldn't lead you down a certain path.
No.
It leads you to a point or a place where there's a vista of experiences that are yours.
Yes.
So I want to make that clear from my own standpoint. I never expected that to happen, and it never has.
Yeah. Well, certainly my goal is to be as neutral as possible, and I'm very happy that you perceive our work in that way. So, and we have further, just what you mentioned about physiological changes. Interestingly enough, most of the time when people are in a state of hypnosis, their blood pressure will be lowered than their norm. Their respiration is lowered and their pulse is lowered. It's simply a result of that, of the deeply relaxed state that you are in. Now, we have found that in working in real time and with the extraterrestrials that you communicate with, that you go through physical changes, as you mentioned, that are contrary to what one would expect from normal hypnosis. You've had elevated blood pressure, significantly elevated blood pressure, as well as pulse and respiration, which is not something that we would see, even if someone is recalling traumatic events. The fact of being hypnotized keeps those physiological parameters, you know, at a lower level. So this is one of the interesting things that I would also like to explore with other experiencers. Do they go through these kinds of physiological changes when either recounting abductions or significant experiences or working in real time?
I would have thought the same thing too, that you'd be just totally calm and consistent.
Mm-hmm.
But if anything, I've been quite inconsistent. Yeah. And I know some of the temperature changes in this room have been noticed by you as not just by me.
No, completely palatable. And at times I wished, oh my gosh, I wish I had an EMF meter. I can perceive that we may do further experimentation along these lines with tracking the perceptible differences when one of the beings comes into contact with us, and I think that they want us to do that. They seem to understand that we need proof. I think they're getting it, that we are curious and literal, and we need proof.
And we're not buffoons, and we're not unconscious.
No.
And I think that's why we're here to do this interview.
Yeah.
Because we want to put the word out. We want to add an intelligent slant to this. And we want to say this is not the kooks of the world.
Definitely. And I absolutely, it's a goal of mine to demystify the process of the work that we're doing with yourself as an experiencer, and also demystify the Hollywood idea of hypnosis and hypnotherapy in general. It is a therapeutic tool that goes back to time immemorial. I mean, the Greeks and the Egyptians had what they called sleep temples, where they would get the, I would say patient, because people were there usually for illness. They would get the patient into an altered state, usually with something like, probably some opiate or something. They would use something to get somebody in an altered state. And then two priests would walk the patient through a kind of a stone maze that they had set up in the sleep temple, and priests would be hiding in these little hidey holes where they couldn't be seen, and they would be whispering positive messages about healing to the patient who was being walked through this maze in an altered state. So that was hypnosis, pure and simple. So it goes back as a treatment to the dawn of time, and probably comes from our friends originally anyway. And on that note, maybe we'll wrap up. Now, Wes, is there some sort of email that you could give, or you would like to be contacted if anyone wants to contact you as opposed to me? Or
Surely. I can be reached at, and for some of you out there, you might look this up at some point because it's a piece of fiction, but the first part of the email address is kadath, that's K-A-D-A-T-H, at simpatico.ca. So if you're curious about that, you can ask me one day, but I welcome your contact. I want to just put out a little bit of a caveat. I'm not a support group.
No.
I don't want to be a support group.
No.
I don't want to get together and cry over your latest experience or mine. That's not what I'm here about. Mm-hmm. I think these beings want us to move forward in an intelligent, organized way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm here. So I welcome your contact at that address.
Thank you so much, Wes. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, and I hope we've covered a lot of things that will be helpful to our listeners out there, and we look forward to hearing from each and every one of you.
Thanks a lot, Leslie.
Thank you.